It is Saturday, August 23rd, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we're talking about malware and how the criminal masterminds of the world are using the internet to steal money and information. Pretty good show right here, right now, on KUSP.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
This is Geek Speak. In the air with me is Geek Miles Elam. He's a student, programmer, and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And in just a moment, we will have Alex Lias from Orange County. He's our Southern California geek, and he runs our forums. So if you haven't gone to the Geek Speak forums to ask questions...
Our Southern California correspondent.
Correspondent, that's right. So we'll have him in just a minute as soon as I figure out the Skype interface that we're using today. So while I'm doing that, Miles, what's the news story you have first today?
Some folks have released a tool that will allow you to gain access to a Gmail account. This is by stealing the IDs of non-encrypted sessions. So after you've logged into Gmail, when you're logging in, putting in your username and password, that is always going to be using a secure connection using SSL or TLS. And that's where you see the HTTPS instead of HTTP in the URL bar when you're putting in Gmail. Into your browser. However, once you get into Gmail, a lot of times things aren't always secure. When you're in the browser, sometimes they are. Sometimes if you're going through a standard email client, however, people tend to be a bit more lax. This is a problem. So the solution to it is really, there's a solution right now, which you can go to gmail.com. Or rather go to mail.google.com, change your account settings, and make sure that everything is set to SSL, including sending and receiving email. However, if you don't turn on SSL, anyone who had the ability to listen in on the conversation, which would be anyone who was on your network that had a sniffer, or if you had spyware installed in your system, they could find out your Gmail account, find out your credentials, and... do all sorts of chicanery.
I don't understand, Miles. How can Gmail, which is like this amazing company in a lot of ways, do something so inappropriate as to let a lot of people log in without being secure? I don't understand why they would do that.
This is something that I've tried to think of a good analogy for with regard to programming, because the folks at Google, when looking at Gmail, Gmail is an amazing piece of software. There are some pieces of software that have better records than others, but in general, I tend to think of code as being like you're having to take an algebra test and you have to get everything right. You know, you have to take that math test and you have to get everything right. And I'm wondering if you ever had those times where you've taken a math test and you just guessed, especially if it was multiple choice, and you got the right answer. But it wasn't because you knew how to get the right answer or because you followed the correct process. You just happened to get the right answer. I think that's what this ends up being, is that it was a failure of imagination. You didn't see the possibility of this being a problem. And so, you know, there's a security bug. You need to, you know, patch it. So that's
what you think it is. Okay. No,
yeah.
That's fair
I'm
enough.
Sorry. I actually misspoke when I... said this story. Looks like I haven't woken up completely. It isn't when you're using an external client with Gmail, although you should have all of your connections with Gmail be secured through TLS encryption. The problem is that the cookie that's sent through Gmail is sent or it allows for non-SSL authentication with your session ID. That's the part that you need to go in and make sure that that's always...
But see, that's the thing is, why would Gmail ever set the cookie unless you're using HTTPS? I mean, that's the thing is that it was their choice to do that. That's the part that confuses me. But in any case, I think we should go on to the next news story. And it's going to have to still be you because I'm still working out this thing with Skype. So
that's fine. Although I'm kind of scattered this morning, I'll try to get myself together here.
I can actually probably bring I can probably bring Alex on, so maybe.
As we have some.
Yeah.
We're through being cool.
Yeah, we're not
we're
being cool today, that's for sure.
Being cool. So, Comcast is looking to slow down their heaviest net users. Whereas before, there was some complaint that Comcast was planning on cutting off users if they had used too much bandwidth. They got a lot of pushback from users saying, wait a second, you haven't told us how much bandwidth is too much. You know, what's the cutoff point? The cutoff point seemed different in different areas or for different users or different times of days. Well, they're still not giving people information about when they're going to be cutting them off, but at least they're not cutting them off completely. What Comcast is talking about doing now is reducing the speed of that user that they consider having an overage so that you're going down to a typical DSL experience instead of cable. Nowadays, cable has been outstripping the speed of DSL, so a lot of people are getting cable because it is faster. Then apparently, if you actually take advantage of that speed too often, you're going to get cut back to DSL. But
are they going to do one of those things where they don't tell you still?
They're still not giving a firm answer as to how much is too much.
All right.
That still hasn't changed. But if they do cut you down to DSL speeds, you're still going to be paying cable prices.
Of course. Hey, Alex.
Yes, Lyle?
You are on with us. Why don't you cover the next news story? This is Alex.
Be sure to speak up.
Yeah.
Will do.
Your volume is fine as long as you don't play with your microphone too much. Go ahead.
Okay. So what I came across is that China has apparently blocked iTunes. At least that's what people are believing. The suspicion is that there was an album out regarding Tibetan freedom that came out just recently. And pretty much all this week, nobody in China has been able to access iTunes, which I thought was just kind of an interesting thing that China just decided to kind of lock things out just because of an album and kind of block everybody from all of the iTunes music.
Yeah, I did hear about this story. Do you think it was pretty clear that it was most likely some of the content on the iTunes store. Again, this just kind of happened without any kind of announcement or anything. There's no public confirmation from China that they're doing this. It's just no longer available in China to
right. Can
access the iTunes store.
Yeah, exactly. And it looks like it's, people are just they're drawing conclusions that they, it's what they believe, but it's it's just something that's kind of highly suspect. And China does block, various content, different sites and known for some time, including I think even I believe Google does specialized filtering on their searches, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. But that, of course, that's been standard. The switching off of iTunes is kind of a new thing. So why don't you cover the e-voting workaround?
E-voting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, we kind of have had some e-voting for a little while now, and states have been adopting it more and more lately, where you have the little touch screen, the electronic e-voting, and you kind of go in and press little buttons, and at the end, usually, hopefully, it depends on some systems, they don't, but you get a little receipt kind of showing what it is you voted on, or at least a confirmation number. Well, states have been pulling back from using these systems. There's a lot of concerns about the security, the reliability, the fact that there's, no audit trail on a lot of these systems. So there's been they're estimating that they're going to be, instead of having about half of the population voting through electronic touchscreen systems, that they think they're going to see about a third instead.
But why exactly would they see the only a third?
Well, states have actually been choosing to go back to simpler systems.
So not the choice of the voters themselves, but of the representatives that are doing the voting booths and such.
Right. Well, I mean, the representatives are supposed to be representing the people, but they're I guess there are concerns. Just people are concerned. The representatives are concerned that they can't properly represent votes, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, of course, it is. What's that?
Pregnant? No, it's just a pregnant pause. And no dead air. No dead air. No.
Got to laugh through it, huh? Well, let's go ahead and invite Joe on. Joe is the director of malware research at SecureWorks. And I guess he's not actually on the phone right now. Hopefully he'll call back.
Have a correction for the Gmail story.
Right.
Or rather, an addition.
Wait a second, because you corrected it halfway into the story. So
right, I know. Okay, I'm just having a bad day. So, Lyle, you would ask me why they would do such a thing, why they would have that type of thing. And I was thinking it was just an oversight. And it turns out that SSL, because it has a higher overhead in terms of bandwidth and a higher overhead in terms of CPU time, they actually made that choice for people who are still on dial-up systems, so they can still use the Gmail system.
Okay, I can totally understand getting your email and everything through a non-secure connection. What I don't understand is why they didn't do this. I mean, this is a fairly simple process to do, and Gmail is full of, I mean, Google's full of geniuses, in my opinion. But what you do is you... The first time you log in, when you actually send your username and password, you use SSL, which is low amount of traffic, so it's not going to really cause that much of a problem. You then get a cookie that only works for a day, and that cookie is a hash of some information so that Google can then check it to make sure it's valid. And then you use your session, and then within a day, you're going to have to prompt again. So you're able to not ever have your password be in the clear, and then you're also only... giving people in the clear a temporary authentication thing.
On the contrary, that is actually how it already works. They have to hit a checkbox to be logged in for 2 weeks. But if you don't do that, it is just a session cookie. So after you're done, if you close the browser, it's gone. The issue is, and it's not sending your username and password, it has a session ID. It's a session ID that's going back and forth. But if you have the session ID...
You can still check it and keep the session live for 2 weeks.
Right, and you can't tie You can't tie it to IP address because, for example, I'm on a laptop.
My IP address.
If I go from one location to another, my IP address is going to change.
Yeah, and that actually even occurs for some users during their session. I know AOL will a lot of times have multiple IPs that they kind of round robin or route people around. I see that on my site all the time, and I can't narrow it down to IP for sessions.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean that issue with not expiring sessions, it should be expired on the server as much as it is on the client. You shouldn't leave that around for too long. It's session hijacking. It's a big one of the big common issues.
Joe is the director of malware research at SecureWorks. He researches unusual internet activity to discover emerging threats, new attack techniques, and the latest malicious code. Prior to this role, Joe was an intrusion analyst where he handled millions of security events for SecureWorks clients while monitoring their corporate networks from the Secure Corporation Center. And Joe, I guess now your job is more direct. You are just doing research on malware. That's your core focus.
Yeah, that's correct.
And Joe, can you tell me a little bit about the CoreFlood malware virus, whatever the heck it is?
Sure. Well, CoreFlood is a Trojan, and it's basically designed to steal data from computers. It only infects Windows machines, and then connects back to a controller, and it gets instructions on what to do next. And in most cases, it's not only stealing, bank passwords and credit card details like we've seen from previous banking Trojans in the past. This thing is actually just capturing everything you do. So every time you post a form to a secure site, no matter what it is, that's being sent back to the hackers. And for good measure, they will also copy the text of the page that you're visiting and send that back too, so they get a little bit of context there.
So when you say they're capturing everything, I mean, a bank transaction is using SSL. We've all been trained to look for the little lock symbol and make sure that HTTPS is in the headline. How is this thing getting around that?
Well, like a lot of banking Trojans do nowadays, they're actually hooking into your browser, so they get that information before it's sent through the SSL channel.
Okay, so they're attached to your browser and seeing anything that gets sent to the browser and comes back from the browser. And is that the plugin? They're not doing, like, keystroke analysis? They're just doing browser analysis?
It can do keylogger functions too, but generally what is being sent through the browser is good enough.
Now, this thing first came around in like 2000 or something, right? How is it that it's not first gone, and why don't we have virus protection that works with it?
Yeah, well, we first saw it around 2002, and it's been pretty consistently under the radar during most of that time. So the antivirus companies... we'll get a sample of it, perhaps, and it might be a week or two after it's been released before they get their hands on it and they can actually write protection for it. Every time a new variant comes out, they've got to basically go back and start from scratch and write new detection for it. So they're just playing this game over and over again. The bad guys, can run their code through the exact same antivirus engines, mm-hmm. and tell when they're being detected. So they say, aha, well, it's time to go change our code again. And they just do that over and over.
Now, if they have breached someone's computer somehow and got this Trojan onto their computer and it's now running, and then a new virus patch comes out and they grab a copy of the most recent update, are they able to then modify their code remotely on someone's computer so that then when the person actually installs antivirus, it doesn't find it?
No, they're not able to update the code on the computer itself. What will happen is the bot will check in every so often, and it will see if there's a new version of the software to be pulled down. So it's possible that the antivirus companies can beat them in that race, but it doesn't happen very often.
So the scenario does fit that if my machine is infected and Symantec comes out with a brand new virus protection and I wait a week, during that time my machine might have went and checked these criminals' website, found the most recent version, said, oh, that's going to beat antivirus protection from Symantec, uploaded it, and then when I actually run Symantec a week later, it won't find it.
Exactly.
That's pretty devious. Miles, you had a question?
I was actually curious if virus authors have started to manipulate antivirus programs themselves, similar to a rootkit, but for the antivirus program, to actually rewrite the code of the antivirus program so that it can't detect. It just came up as a possibility in as a hypothetical. I was wondering if that's ever come up.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do modify the operating system, at the rootkit level, so they're affecting the calls that the antivirus is going to use to detect them. So in a way, they are kind of modifying the antivirus, but they're not actually directly affecting the antivirus code in order to do it. They're just taking advantage of, the antivirus has to go through the operating system just like everything else. In order to read the NTFS file system, they've got to use the NTFS driver. And so the bad guys just hook into that at the very lowest level and, make sure that they're not going to be detected on the disk.
Right, then they would catch every antivirus program and not just one vendor.
Right.
We had a quick question about security and that your question, your post, Miles, about Gmail and the security breach. And the answer is, how do you protect yourself from Gmail, from people seeing it, especially when you're in a non-secure environment, meaning you're using a machine wirelessly? Just add HTTPS in the beginning of the Gmail session, and your whole session will be through a secure connection. That's what the article recommends.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was under the impression you actually had to go into the settings to say always leave it as SSL on.
Inside Gmail?
Yeah.
So inside Gmail, what you can do is go into settings and probably under security tab. But Miles will check it, and we'll get back to you in just a second. Alex, I know you've got a lot of questions for Joe. It's one of your hobbies is security, right?
Yeah, a little bit. I tend to tinker, I guess, a little bit in security here. Actually, one of the questions I kind of had was, if this is basically an arms race, you're dealing with antivirus companies kind of trying to keep up and getting new signatures out and getting the users to update these signatures. Meanwhile, you've got the malware developers and the criminals out there who are fairly well-funded kind of coming up with new things. I mean, and not just specifically with Core Flood, but in general. Joe, I'm kind of curious what your take is on, who's winning this arms race. Is it the good guys or the bad guys?
Oh, I'm sorry, Joe. You can't hear him, can you?
Yeah, I'm afraid not.
Oh, okay.
Well, so he's like hearing dead silence.
Now you can hear him. Alex, I'm so sorry. Go ahead and repeat.
All right. I'll sum that out nice and short. So what I was going to say, or what I was just asking Joe, is with this whole thing, we basically have an arms race going on, with the antivirus companies trying to come up with new DATs, new updates to detect the viruses. Then you have the virus developers and the criminals out there coming up with new code to escape and get around this. So we have this arms race. I was just kind of wondering what your take was in terms of who's winning, the good guys or the bad guys.
Hmm.
I would say the bad guys are definitely winning at this point.
That's depressing. That's,
yeah, as long as you're always enumerating the bad is always going to increase faster than the good.
Yeah.
That made no sense. Okay.
All of this, coming from a geek standpoint, you always look at it like, how can we solve this problem? What can we do from a technical standpoint to fix what's happening out there? And, I've had to put that way of thinking aside and realize that there is really no technical problem here. This is all just a matter of, some bad guy somewhere trying to get over on you. And so it's really a human problem that you have to solve with human measures. So the cat and mouse game kind of it's going to be perpetual.
But
you have to have something to back that up in the human world.
Joe, I don't know if that's true. I think there are technical solutions, aren't there?
Well, there's stop gaps, yeah.
But I mean, for example, they're getting an exploit into the machine somehow. Why is software set up in such a way that they're able to get into the OS in the first place? Now, you saying that that's a actual social engineering issue, not a
yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, this is the way. Once we close the holes that they leave with the exploits and the vulnerabilities, they just switch right over to social engineering, and it works really well.
We had Kevin Mitnick on a long time ago on GeekSpeak. Actually, it's one of our first podcasts. You can download it. But he's a kind of an infamous hacker of the 80s and 90s. And he had a great thing in one of his books where if you want to get an application to run on a person's computer, it's really not that hard. You can, for example, go to a corporation into the elevator and drop a CD on the ground that says, human resources, salaries 08-09, right? And just drop it on the floor. Now, either a person will pick it up and be kind of devious and go put it in their computer and look up the information, and in so doing, infect their machine, or they'll hand it to some HR person who will then look at it and infect the machine. And it's an easy way to run software. It's not hard to run software on somebody else's computer if you do a little bit of trickery. So I get what you're saying, that it's a social issue, not a technical issue. At the same time, why aren't Macintoshes affected?
Well, Macintoshes are starting to be affected. I mean, we've started to see some of the lower level fake spyware type of applications started being compiled for Macs. So as that audience grows, they're going to focus on them as well.
Right.
So they're not immune. I mean, it's something that even if you try to take the user out of the equation as much as possible, you get to the point where you can't really run anything on your machine because you can never know what the intent of that software is. That's what it all comes down to. What defines malware as opposed to a program you want? It's what the intent of the author is, and that's just something you can't tell programmatically.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about how bad the situation is. You actually were able to take over a computer that was using Core Flood. It was kind of a server for Core Flood. And when you seized the machine and took a look at it, you kind of did forensics on it. You have a great report about it. You found out that for bank account and credit card unions, there were 8,485 usernames and passwords. There were credit card usernames in the neighborhood of 3,000. Email accounts, 150,000. Social networking sites, 58,000. We're talking about some serious information about people. And that was all on one server. And when you took it down, it was a domain name, and then it came back up again. Is that right?
Yes. So we were able to get the hosting provider where the server was physically located to take that offline. But not the domain name itself. So, 3 days later, they're back up in operation in another country.
Right. Well, we are talking about Core Flood, a virus that's out and about, malware that's out and about, with Joe Stewart. Joe Stewart is the director of malware research at SecureWorks. This is GeekSpeak. You're welcome to call us up now with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Stay with KWSP at 11 a.m. for Castle Cottage this morning. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam and Alex Leas. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are speaking with Joe Stewart. And you're welcome to call us with questions and comments about technology. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. Alex.
Yeah?
Go ahead. Did I surprise you? I'm sorry. I thought you had something.
Yeah, sorry. Actually, I do have a question that I'd like to make sure we get asked Joe.
Mm-hmm.
If people are, either trying to protect themselves from getting something like Core Flood or malware, what are some of the best things they can do? And if they think they have had it or their antivirus software says, hey, I cleaned this up, what should they do to kind of protect themselves?
Well, preventing getting it in the first place is the best thing. And, with Core Flood, it's not social engineering at this time. So it's still relying on browser exploits. So having either your browser completely patched, and that includes any ActiveX controls or any plugins, having them all up to date too, is your best first line of defense. Using an alternative browser might add some extra layer of protection, and then obviously moving to a completely different operating system might protect you even more, at least from core flood.
Did you see how many of the browsers contacting the server you're able to take over were Windows Internet Explorer versus Firefox and so on? Were they keeping the user agents information?
Yeah. What we were able to see logged was not the actual exploit, but after the Trojan was connecting
was installed,
back, and at that point it's running as a standalone process.
Is the Trojan actually contacting, or is it going through the browser to contact the server?
The Trojan is actually contacting.
Okay.
That.
I was interested in this, Alex, too, on how do you stop this thing. And so I was reading your report, Joe, on deactivating it, and it seems to me that you're kind of speaking to pretty technically minded people about intercepting DNS and telling the virus to uninstall itself by pretending that you are the host that it's trying to contact. That's a pretty clever way of doing it, but it's not exactly something anyone can do.
No.
The average user.
Yeah.
It was designed for network administrators because one of the key things that sets CoreFlood apart from a lot of the other bots that infect people's computers is they have been very successful at taking over computers and entire networks at once. So, it works like this. You've got a corporate domain that's running a Windows domain, and the domain administrator logs into an infected workstation, and then now the Trojan, when it starts up, it has domain administrator credentials, and it's able just to roll out an update to all of the machines in the domain, just like, they'd roll out patches. And
Whoa.
It will infect every single machine on the network. So this has been a huge problem for a lot of companies and organizations. So, this is basically, the only thing we could really do for them to help them, in a mass way deal with this.
And now it's no longer the network admin that could just point to the individual user saying, quit clicking on those email attachments.
Right, it's the
right.
admin
itself. And in this case, the user could have been, doing everything right. And following every type of security, measure to the T, but, their network infector, the network administrator is the one who infected them, and, they are now part of this botnet and now sending their banking details back to the hackers.
And I would assume this is not just for corporate networks when you've got domain controllers. You're seeing this also in people's homes and such, too, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not picky about who it infects on the first stage. It's just that it has this basically a trap set
for domain
administrators.
Yeah. And when we say exploits and stuff, we cover exploits all the time on GeekSpeak. We're always mentioning, try to use Firefox, it's safer, or another alternative browser. And what you're saying is that anytime we've reported on some kind of exploit like the JPEG exploit or another kind of thing of that nature, a JavaScript exploit or a Flash plugin exploit, when we talk about those things, those are the kind of stuff that they're looking for and targeting and trying to develop ways of breaching the machine with.
Is exactly.
Right? And so it's kind of all over the map on how you get infected. Now, I guess the thing is, if my virus protection software doesn't detect it, and this kind of goes back to Alex's question, how do people protect themselves? I mean, do we need to go to the point where we have our ISPs actually scanning our network and looking for the signatures of this virus in the traffic?
Well, I think Joe is pretty much right on it. I mean, he was saying that you need to keep your software up to date, and it's right now I think that's one of your best protections. And one of the things that I think should be worth mentioning also is if you do find that you happen to have some malware or you're infected, and especially with something like CoreFlood, which has been highly associated with banking industry and targeting you're getting your bank credentials and all that, is if you think you've been infected, go find a computer you think is not and go change your passwords right away. Way, at least the stuff that they stole is not as useful to them.
And finding a computer that's not, how do you do that? I mean, I guess you could go use a friend's Macintosh.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, a system that at least you reasonably don't think has been infected. I mean,
right.
Do something to don't use the same computer, basically, that you know has been infected. Don't go and just use it to go and change your password before being sure that it's clean and safe. So
in your report, you mentioned that over $90,000 was taken from one individual's bank account with this virus. And if you look into the details, check to figure out how much money was available to them just from this one server, it was like a couple million, $2.5 million.
Right. And, that's...
Yeah, why didn't they take more money before you took over the server?
Well, that was just one, basically, we took one bank and broke it down by, you know, what were in those accounts. Because, like I said before, it pulls down the result page of any post you make.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see people's balances after they pass that login page.
Without even logging in and
right.
doing it. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So we took, you know, what it had saved when it ran one of these account test runs. That's what it is basically. They'll take a group of accounts and they'll run it through a script and try to log into each one and get a copy of that balance. So that's we are able to take that data and just for that one bank figure out how much they probably had.
And that's only.
So they've got access to far more than that.
We don't know
how much they've stolen. I mean, we know in the case in Florida, you know, that it was $90,000 because that person came forward and, you know, it was made a big deal about it and you know, Bank of America was telling them, you know, you can't get that money back or whatever. For the most part, what these guys are stealing, we're never going to know about. You know, the banks aren't going to tell us.
Okay, from Santa Cruz, we're going to have Perry. Hi, welcome, Perry, to GeekSpeak. Perry, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hi, welcome. You're on air.
Hi, I had a question. Just listening to you guys speak, like, are there some forums out there or good resources or good venues to kind of, for me, like, I work in IT, kind of mid-level network administrator, I guess. Is there some sort of forum where I can just kind of keep on top of, like, you know, threats as they emerge?
Joe or Alex?
Go ahead, Joe.
Go ahead.
I'd suggest looking into SANS Internet Storm Center is a good source to find out what's shaking in the internet security world. That's basically just a daily diary or blog, pretty much from a group of different people that are doing security 24/7. And then
these will be on our website, Perry. But it was SANS Internet Security Center, and we'll have all these up on the GeekSpeak website.
Okay. Right, and then the Castle Cops website is a good place to go and know what's going on in the world of malware and phishing and things like that.
And that's Castle Cops.
Right.
All right, we'll put SANS Internet Security Center and Castle Cops online. Miles, can you handle that? The two?
Sorry, I was working on something else. I was working on the Gmail thing.
Alex, what else do you look at?
I mean, there's a number of sites. I think SANS and Castle Cops are some of the good ones out there. But also, even some of the more commonly known ones like Security Focus, there's a lot of information that's shared between all these different sites. I think even Security Focus is a pretty good one, especially for somebody who's just trying to keep aware about what's going on out there. But I think it's good to have at least two or three just to have it to your toolkit, I guess.
I guess I'm kind of concerned, and I'm assuming I'm in the same kind of situation as Perry is, that I'm an IT guy, I'm a geek guy, I know a lot about computers, but I've got a Windows machine at home, and I'm not really sure if it's safe and secure, and I never feel like I'm really on top of that. And so every once in a while, I'll wipe the system and reinstall the OS, and I don't do my banking on that machine. How do you get the feeling of safety and security on your computer? Joe, how do you do it?
I don't use Windows, I guess I got to admit. But if I did, I would probably be investing a lot of time in just learning how these things hook into the system. And then, there's things you can do to remove the ability of these little rootkits and things like that to hide on your Windows system. You can get a Linux rescue CD, one that'll boot up an NTFS file system, and you can just take a look. And, if you know what to look for, registry keys and where these files tend to hide and what should and shouldn't be there, you could go in at a low level and make sure that your system didn't have anything suspicious on it. Now, it requires a lot of expertise and a lot of learning. So, yeah, there's really not a way for somebody that, isn't fully, committed to that level, of learning to ever be sure that there's not something lurking on the machine.
With regard to security, I'm curious as to why we are still, as a community or as a industry, still concentrating on let's try to find the bad things instead of enumerating this is what's supposed to be there and anything else isn't supposed to be there.
You're talking about whitelists instead of blacklists?
Right.
All right. It's definitely headed in that direction. So we've got antivirus vendors now you know, basically advertising that they're going to come out with products in the very near future that do whitelisting. And, you know, that's going to help a lot. It's not a perfect solution. I mean, then you're still up against, you know, having to code perfectly so that there's no vulnerabilities that allow something to slip through because, you know, code doesn't always have to come as an executable. You know, it can just be a tiny payload and do what it needs to without actually having anything written to the disk. So, you know, you're still not 100% with whitelisting, but you'd be a lot closer. But the reason it hasn't been adopted before is it's just a convenience issue. People like to just be able to download whatever they want, you know, software of the day and install it on their systems. So it's just a matter of getting away from that that mindset. We're not in the era where you can do that anymore.
And also, I mean, in the case of with CoreFlood, doesn't it kind of just load itself as a helper application in IE? And it's one of the common things I've seen it do. And that's something people would want to be able to do. So how do I mean, like you said, it's a convenience factor in that there's so much people want to be able to just download and run. And then if everyone's computer starts whitelisting, who's controlling what is an okay piece of software and what people are allowed to use at home?
How do you
this sounds kind of wrong.
How do you trust the whitelist? Yeah.
At the same time, I know that with my Macintosh, when I've downloaded a file through Safari and then I double-click on it, I get a message that says, this program has been downloaded from the internet. Are you sure you want to execute it?
Right, but so if your machine was infected, Miles, that doesn't have to come up.
I'm talking about the avoiding infection in the first place.
Right. Well, for running things, but when we're talking about exploits, I mean, Mac OS and every OS has exploits. They're listed
that's
all
true,
the time. They're
right.
patched all the time. It really has to do with how close that window is, and that's one of the things that frustrates me about Tuesdays, every first Tuesday of the month, Microsoft releases a whole bunch of vulnerabilities. That means there's 3 weeks or 4 weeks of vulnerabilities being out in the wild without any patch available at all. How do you protect yourself from that?
Or for that matter, folks that may have a piece of malware, they'll wait for the Tuesday release and then publish
check
on
it.
Wednesday.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
So they have the maximum amount of window.
Yeah, well, also that when you have things like CoreFlood out there that kind of can lay dormant and just wait for something like that, it scares me to think that you could have companies with infestations, home computers with infected with this that just people just don't know and it lies quiet. And all of a sudden, some zero-day exploit comes out. They tell the bot, "Hey, come download this and run it on that person's computer," and you have exploits that can do a lot more. That's kind of scary.
Hey, Perry, did we answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We've got links of like 4 different sites that a lot of these security people read and check out. So if you want to be more on top of it, I'd recommend it. Thank you very much for the call, Perry.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you'd like to ask questions of today's geek guest, please give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. KUSP. And we're taking questions about security and malware and viruses and all that kind of stuff. Joe Stewart's our guest. And Joe, what is your biggest concern about these viruses still being out and about, or these malware applications being out and about?
Well, my biggest concern is the kind of damage they can do to somebody, financially. I mean, this can really hurt people. You know, this isn't just nuisance stuff. It's not just spam anymore. You know, this is stuff that's, not only stealing your bank accounts, but stealing, the details of everything you're doing online. And we're seeing more and more malware do that nowadays. So, I mean, the potential for abuse there is huge. And I think the thing that just worries me the most is that people just really aren't aware to the extent of what's happening nowadays.
Yeah. Well, we got a call from Albert. Pretty much on topic. So, Albert from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question?
Oh, hi, Lyle. I was calling to ask how it is that people can steal from a bank account and actually handle the money at some point. It seems unbelievable that a bank like Bank of America somehow would not be able to track where the money went to when it was transferred.
Oh, good question. Thank you, Albert. Joe?
All right. So, these guys aren't going to just directly write a check to themselves. What they're going to do is they recruit money mules, they're called, and these are just kind of unsuspecting people that all they need to do is have a bank account, and they too can make $5,000 to $6,000 every week. So they basically just have to have a bank account. The bad guys will empty the money out of your account, transfer it into this other account, and the money mule will get to keep a percent of that money, and then they basically take it and Western Union it, then and wire it off to another country somewhere where, you know, you can wire money and it can be picked up anonymously. All you need to know is the code and, you know, and a general visit city that it's going to be sent to, show up at one of the offices and pick up your cash.
So when you say mule, there's somebody in the same bank that has an account that you then transfer the money into?
Right. And that's how it works in some cases. In other cases, they're looking for commercial accounts where you can actually wire money directly out of the account.
I see. So the actual company account would then have the ability to wire directly to anybody, even anonymous wire.
Right.
Wow. And you said how much money could one of these accounts pull in, $5,000 a week?
Oh, you know, I'm just throwing out a figure there. I mean, they basically have these pitches that you see in spam and other places where they have this, you know, job offer that sounds too good to be true. Work from home, earn, you know, how much ever per month, and you know, people really do earn money that way. Unfortunately, it's all illegal, and at some point, you know, they're going to have the cops knocking on their door.
And then they're the pansy that gets set up.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. They take the fall, and the money, you know, stays overseas.
Yeah, wow. And I think I've seen some of those emails out and where they say, you know, I've got some money from some relative that just died and, you know, I just need to get this kind of cleared out into the country and, you know, I'll give you 10% or something like that. And I'm sure that's part of it. And a lot of people probably do fall for it.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to launder the money online. They've got different ways of doing it, but they don't have any trouble getting the money out of the banks.
Wow.
I see.
Thank you very much, Albert, for the question.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
You bet. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Joe Stewart, he's a security expert. We also have Alex Leas from Southern California, Miles Elam, and myself. You're welcome to ask us questions about malware and virus protection and bank fraud, all those kind of things. Please give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, those phone numbers, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Alex, I'm going to throw the ball back to you because I know that this is one of your hobbies. You're really pretty into it. So,
yeah. Actually, I just thought it was interesting that you mentioned earlier, Joe, that this isn't just people doing spam anymore. And, you know, it's bank fraud and wire transfer fraud and all this other stuff that's, you know, very financially oriented. I mean, these people are pretty smart now. It's not like some script kiddie going out there and downloading some program that can go and hack computers. These guys are smart. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, what your take is and how they've progressed from being the simpler mind of just some kid wanting to prove themselves to now where you have organized, well-funded organized crime. You know, where are we headed with this?
Well, we're headed to, you know, where it gets worse before it gets better. I mean, they really have a whole economy built around this. They've got different criminals provide different services to each other. They have message boards where they communicate, and you know they offer up their services. And you know it's all very clear. You know the kind of illegal activity they're engaging in, but they're doing it pretty much out in the open because they really do feel that they're somewhere that they're untouchable.
Now, so there's some forum where they organize and talk, and it's online. And theoretically, I could go join that forum and listen in on the conversation, right?
In some cases, you could. There are different levels of, you know, underground type forums. So if you start out in one of the public forums and you make a reputation for yourself and, you know, provide services and somebody else can vouch for you that, you know, yeah, that I bought some, you know, credit card numbers from this guy and he's good, then you might be able to get your way into the more underground forums. But yeah, and a lot of them you can just join and or you only have to join and you can read what they're talking about.
So how is it that they're not tracked and arrested?
They are occasionally. You know, we saw a few years ago a very famous Carter forum taken down, Carter Planet, and there was another one, Shadow Crew, and you know they got a good number of those guys. They certainly didn't get them all. I mean, if you go to these forums and look and see. You know, how many users are registered even? I mean, it's usually, you know, in the thousands. So they certainly didn't round up that many people. And, mm-hmm. and a lot of times they are able to get the people that they can reach. They can actually, you know, get from countries that might have some sort of treaty with us for extradition. But most of these guys, you know, they just stay, you know, in their country and do their thing. And we have a hard time getting to them.
All right. We've got another call, this time from Santa Cruz again. Jackie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, hello. What you describe on the banking situation is rather scary and devastating, and I'm wondering, could at least a stopgap for people who are concerned be to tell my bank that they should not transfer money to anyone other than my specified bill pay payees without my express notice?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, yeah, if they can't transfer the money out of the banks, I mean, a lot of this activity would just go away.
So right? can you put a transfer lock hold on your bank?
I don't know, but I mean, it sounds like anything of what we ever thought banks were, they had to take some responsibility for not taking your money, giving it to somebody. I would think I could call up and they get them on that.
Well, I think that if you sent a letter to your bank and said, please don't transfer except for to these accounts, anything until you hear in written, you know, from me, they probably will do nothing with that. And eventually, if someone does hack your account, the bank will be completely responsible because you told them not to. So there's that safety protocol. Alex, you know a bit about banking. Do you think that banks are doing this kind of thing?
I don't really all know all that much about, you know, how the banking industry works. I think it really could depend on the bank. And, I mean, they may not have the systems in place that allow for specialized cases and saying this account can do this kind of transfer and this kind of – I mean, some do, I'm sure. And I'm sure at larger level or higher levels, especially with corporate accounts and stuff, they probably have a little bit more controls. But I'm not sure about consumer accounts. I'm not sure how much – I mean, the best thing I could say is call your bank and ask them – what kind of controls can you put in place? But
yeah.
Also, keep in mind that you can't, that you might be putting restrictions on yourself and what you can do with your account at the same time.
Well, I know. It's why I just wish that when you came out with things that were this terrible,
there were good
frightening
solutions.
That you would come out with thinking through what to do.
Well, keep in mind, Jackie, that we're geeks. Joe works for a security company, and we're interested and concerned about this, but we're not the banking industry. We're not the people that are making the decisions on how you do your work. I mean, there are technical solutions that wouldn't allow some of these things to happen, but they're expensive. But I think as a consumer of your bank, you need to talk to them and tell them your concerns and find out how you can be reassured from them. And I think it's a good thing to do. And I'd be really curious to what you find out from them, Jackie, if you'd like to participate. Tell us what happens. I'd be happy to share with everybody else. Thank you very much, Jackie, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Now, there is a security solution to this that I can think of right off the top of my head. When I've had real high security access to things, corporate high security, I've had like a little numeric counter that I have to carry around, a number that changes every 10 seconds or something, and I have to put that code in during my login attempt, and if I don't have the right code, it fails. That would pretty much stop them from having passwords because there is a continual password code changing all the time. Why isn't that being used?
Well, the bad guys have already worked around that, actually.
How do they work around it?
Well, instead of now getting your password and then going and using it at the bank, they've devised systems that, you know, they've got the Trojan on your machine. It'll wait for you to log into the bank or the financial institution with your token. And then after you've reached the login phase, it'll hijack your browser and basically take over your session. It'll show you one page, and in the background, you'll be transferring some money.
Wow. So it'll do it while you're doing your online banking.
Right.
Oh, man. Well, thank you, Joe, for scaring us. I kind of feel the same. I kind of feel the same as Jackie. I wish there were better answers to this. You said you don't use a Windows machine, and that helps. What are you using, Linux?
Yes, I use Linux.
Well, there's a good reason to get Ubuntu. I mean, here's a good, safe way to do it. You can download or ask for an Ubuntu CD, and it's a live CD. You can put that in your machine, reboot your machine off of that CD, and now your computer will be using that operating system, which won't have any viruses on it or any malware, and you can do your banking that way. And then when you're done, eject the CD and never save anything about your banking information on your computer. That's relatively safe, right, please, Joe?
Pretty much. Just don't get an older CD that has the bad SSH keys on them.
Joe, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Joe Stewart is a security works for Security Works and is a malware inspection guy. And Joe, just great reports. You can learn all more about our discussion and about what the malware looks like right now and some really wonderful reports from our website, geekspeak.org. And again, Joe, thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
And Alex Slias and Miles Elam and Rick Philman for answering phones. Thank you, geeks, for being here today with me.
Glad to be here.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Coming up next, we have Castle Cottage, so stay with us. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Hey, this Saturday, the first man to land a craft onto the moon, astronaut Buzz Aldrin, will join the geeks via phone to talk about the future of space exploration, find out what it was like to step onto another world, to smell moon dust, to see the Earth by itself floating in space, and learn about what we'll do next above and beyond Earth. That's next week on GeekSpeak, Saturday at 10 a.m. with American hero Buzz Aldrin. Broadcasting in HD radio and 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. For GeekSpeak and for KOSP, I'm Lyle Troxell.